Okay, let's come to order. Welcome to the August 8th, 2022 commission meeting. We've got quite a long agenda today, so let's get at it. First off is comments from the public. You can raise your hand or indicate to T that you'd like to have them make a comment.
See, I can hear you talking outside the door here, but you're not coming through on the meeting. I'm not hearing her still, Will. If anybody from the public would like to make a comment, please let me know now so that we can add you to the list. Hearing none, Will.
Okay. All right. Good. Okay, agenda revisions. Sean, do we have any?
Nothing today.
Okay, great. So moving on to the approval for the consent agenda. Okay. We've got five items on there, which were sent out previously. Do we have a motion for approval, a comment, or questions?
I'm good.
Move that we accept the consent agenda.
I second the motion.
Been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for August the 8th, 2022. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Great. Okay, moving on to business items. Our first item is acceptance memo for agreement cost increase, contract number 200332 for LUD3. Tom, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Well, there you go. Take it away, Tom.
So this project is the LUD3 lower pump station relocation project, and it's been going on for quite a while, several years now, through COVID and so forth. And you know, we've been trying to move the pump station out of the geologic hazard zone there next to Ennis Creek, and to a more stable location on Golf Course Road. So we finally got through the purchase and sale agreement with the City of Port Angeles for their property, and it passed the conditional use permit tests. Now we have to officially subdivide the lot, our portion of the lot. So that's going to take extra time to complete, and so this is a request for an increase of $4,806 to extend the contract out to January 31st, 2023 to complete all the design and the subdivision process.
So this is a cost increase as well as a schedule impact. What was the original schedule on this?
The original schedule was to complete it in
got to be a COVID delay, I would assume.
Yeah, 2021, the end of 2021, I believe.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's been multiple changes since then to account for all the different, we really didn't know which property we're going to end up with for the design. And so going through the property selection, there were several alternatives, and we ended up with the City of Port Angeles and trying to get, you know, conditional use permit, purchase and sale agreement. It just takes time working with the city.
Yeah, understood. Questions, comments? Do we have a motion?
I move that we accept memo of agreement cost increase for 200332-LUD3.
I second the motion.
And move and seconded for approval of the acceptance memo for an agreement cost increase for contract number 200 334 for a not to exceed amount of $102,405 and for an extension of the agreement deadline to January the 31st, 2023. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
I'm up next.
Yeah, you are. The next one is the acceptance memo for agreement cost increase 200328. This is the water main. Tom, you're costing us money today.
yeah. Hopefully this will be the last one. You'll see that we're asking for an expiration date on this extension, this change, out to August 10th, which is 2 days from now. This is the Clallam Bay lower CQ design work. And it's essentially complete. You know, we issued the notice to proceed to the construction contractor. Well, you know, that took a lot of work to receive the bids and evaluate them. And that was not in our scope of work with our design contract with Murray Smith and Associates for this project. So I really needed them to evaluate the bids and make a recommendation on which bid to accept as the lowest, most responsible and responsive bidder. So they did that, and they attended a pre-bid meeting as well. That was all out of scope. So they're asking for $4,172 cost increase and to expire on August 10th.
And there was also some DOT delays in this, right?
Yeah, that was the result of a previous change order. Yeah, okay. It was WSDOT, which kept going back and forth to them on what's acceptable pipe replacement along Highway 112.
Okay. So there we have it. We got questions or comments on this one?
I'm good.
Tom, in the future, I'm assuming you'll build in that review period that you didn't have in this one?
Yeah, that fell through the cracks. You know, we had a design contract, the scope of work went through submittal of the bid package, and then our contract for engineering support in construction started with the notice to proceed, so there was that gap in there during the bid process. So yeah, next time I'll remember to include that in.
Great. Thank you, Tom.
We just need boilerplate in our contracts calling for a job walk in the scope, I guess. Okay, do we have a motion on this one?
I move that we accept memo of agreement cost increase for 200328 water main.
I second the motion.
The moved and seconded for approval of acceptance memo for an agreement cost increase for contract number 200328 for a not to exceed amount of $388,467 and for extension of the agreement deadline to August the 10th, 2022. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you again, Commissioners.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom. All right, next item is acceptance memo for completion of 221003. This is the central warehouse roof work, I believe. Kaylee?
Hi. Yes, I would like to present the acceptance memo for this contract, 221022. This was budgeted in 2021, for completion this year. Restoration to the central warehouse roof. We went with CHG Building Systems. Everything has been completed up to standards, necessary services, labors, materials required to clean, prep, and restore the roof here at 100 Hooker Road. This was due to deterioration of the roof sealant and leaking gutters. There were no change orders.
Good work. Questions? Do we have a motion?
I move that we accept memo of completion for 221002-CWF Roof.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded for approval of acceptance memo for completion of contract number 221022 for the Central Warehouse Facility Roof Restoration for a total contract cost of $269,382.72, including Washington State sales tax. All in favor?
Will, I think you got the number wrong. I think it's 221002.
Yeah, mine says 022. Okay.
I will correct that in a minute.
I was just looking at that too, Will. I believe on the agenda it's missing a 2. It should be 221022.
That's what I read out. So which is?
I'm sorry. I was reading from the agenda, which had a different number.
Okay. Yeah, it does. I saw that too, Rick.
So it's 221022. Great. All right. It's been moved and seconded. Did we get a second?
Yeah.
Moved and seconded for approval of acceptance memo for completion of contract 221022 for the Central Warehouse Facility Roof Restoration for a total contract cost of $269,382.72, including Washington State sales tax, as I said before. So all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Next is a presentation on the potential modification to construction costs sharing and any subsequent discussion. Colin, are you ready to go?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Purser. I will start to share my screen here. Okay, can you see my slides saying duty construction cost sharing?
Yes, loud and clear.
All right. Okay, so today we're talking about construction cost sharing. Just a little edit in the packet you have. I have it as PUD line sharing. That's how we refer to it in our department, but technically in Section 3 of our electric service regulations, it's PUD construction cost sharing. So still, I know it might be a little confusing. Okay. So what is sharing? The idea behind sharing is that if you extend a new line, you are entitled to receive a portion of money back from customers that connect to your line within 7 years. On the flip side of that, if you tap on to a line with a new transformer, you have to pay the original pioneer a portion of their installation. The PUD provides a documenting process and payment process to transfer money from one customer to another to make this happen.
So now you're also including in that where you set a transformer on the existing system to serve one house, but it can serve two or more. So that would be the transformer cost as well would be shared.
Well, the transformer itself is a separate fee that we don't include, but the pad that it's sitting on, yes. So the customer would pay a portion of that fee. And I'm going to give an example here soon to kind of lay out how sharing works here, a simple example. So why are we discussing sharing? We've had a single employee that has administered this program for well over 20 years, and that institutional knowledge is going away because of their upcoming retirement. With that, training new employees on every possible way of sharing scenario requires time. When looking at employee time and the actual sharing payouts made, the cost to administer the program is more than twice the payouts that are made. This means that that customers that benefit from this program are a small minority of customers that are actually eligible. This program was originally used by local people regularly to extend power to more remote parcels, and this gave these customers a chance, obviously not a guarantee, to recover some of their costs through the sharing program. This program has had no major changes since 1994, and nowadays most connections are either single customers with little or no chance of another customer tapping off their connection, or customers that are in subdivisions. And with the way those are constructed, sharing is waived by the developer, so there's no chance of sharing for those. This is why we only have about 5 sharings a year, and they tend to be for a small amount of money. From time to time, customers may have disputes over receiving monies after the 7-year mark, and it can be very time-consuming to be in the middle of that. If an error is made in a payout to one customer, it could affect many customers down the line, which opens up utility to liability. The example on the upcoming slide will show how complicated even a simple sharing calculation can get. Removing sharing would not stop customers from negotiating between themselves on a potential line extension. But remember, this program is to facilitate that process for them. We just wouldn't be the middleman anymore in those kind of arrangements. As stated earlier, this program takes time to administer, including filing and calculating sharing on every customer. By eliminating this program, it could free up the employee to do other important departmental work. With the way our department was structured, we used to have a records technician. That was their job title, and this was one of their duties. More recently in 2021, we went through and worked with the union to adjust our job titles to turn our employees into engineering technicians. And that allows them to be more flexible in the range of duties they can do now. So it wouldn't be difficult for us to move this employee over to do other productive work. Lastly, on this slide,
you say negotiate between neighbors. The 7 years still applies to this, or does that go away?
Well, if we eliminated it, yeah, this would be. You could have if you have a large section of parcels open up, customers could work together to provide power to all those lots without us. They could work together and decide how to split up payment. So I guess what I'm saying there is, without a sharing program that we don't administer, it doesn't stop customers from negotiating among themselves before power is installed and how to get power to new parcels.
Yeah, the only problem I can see with that is that somebody puts in a line extension, and then it's maybe 2 or 3 years or longer before they have any neighbors. But anyway.
Yeah, and we just don't see those as often anymore.
Yeah.
It is part of the problem. It's just a lot of the new developments don't end up with it. It's many single customers for a tap just to their property, or like I said, with the subdivisions. Also, too, the water department is looking at their sharing as well and trying to come up with, you know, what they see best for how they're going to do their sharing going in the future. So I'm going to go through these slides, and don't worry, we won't spend a lot of time on them. It's just to kind of lay out an example of how sharing works. So we have customer one who, you know, is the first installation on a line, let's say. So we have that X is a junction box where power can be pulled from, and the dashed line means that's the new installation. So we have that first customer. They connect the line. We call them the pioneer. Then in year two, we have a customer that comes along and wants to tap from their transformer to another lot, just like Will Purser was talking about. So that one's pretty straightforward. Customer two pays for half the cost of the extension that customer one paid for. Makes sense, right? As we go on, things start to get a little more complicated. A new junction box gets installed, and that customer now pays for part of the line extension that customer two paid for, and they end up paying a third of the customer line extension for customer one. We tack that on, and it starts to get a little more complicated. We're breaking up the payments here more, and for customer four, And customer five comes on, and you can see how the payouts start to expand here. And then customer six we have here. And this would be essentially, this example shows if we had seven customers, one customer connecting each year. This is actually somewhat of an oversimplification of how a sharing arrangement could work. Sometimes multiple customers do go in together on lots, and we will, you know, administer that part of it for payments. If someone sells a lot in between this, in the years in between, they're not eligible for sharing anymore, so they drop out and the payment structure changes. And sometimes customers waive sharing, and sometimes you may have customer seven is actually the same customer as customer two. So we don't, you know, they shouldn't have to pay themselves, and they get, they waive sharing. So these are just some of the ways it can be a little complicated. I want to stop here for a second and see if there's any questions about how that works. Okay. So moving forward, what all these numbers on this page basically show is that this program on average is paying out between 4 and 5% of eligible customers. The employee time costs about twice the amount of money to administer it. So we're committing employee time to a process that yields a benefit to just a select number of customers. On this slide, you can also see that a service pole is eligible for sharing. Now, what that means is basically a pole that we put in a person's yard to run our service wire to their house. They're eligible for sharing. And so we have to calculate the benefit. We have to include it in their power line extension agreement. And all that's documented for 7 years. Even though the likelihood of a service pole getting sharing is extremely low for most of our customers, we still need to track it. This next slide here, we went out and Angel Torres, one of our engineering technicians, called.
Hey, Colin.
Yeah.
I think we had a question.
Oh.
Yeah. Do we still cluster transformers on poles or not?
Well,
like what I'm saying is it possible that you put in a pole for a given house and then later on there'd be an additional transformer mounted on it?
When that is possible, we do it. Yes. We try to find the most efficient route. If we can have a customer served by multiple transformers, we will. With the service pole, that's on the low voltage side of the transformer, and those typically, in many of where you have like a 1 acre parcel or half acre parcel, it's not typically feasible for that pole to also feed another customer without procuring an easement that would allow us to cross the property potentially to another house. And those on the secondary side can be very difficult to get.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so like I was saying, Angel looked at, he talked to 26 utilities or tried to talk to 26 utilities, mostly comprised of PUDs and a few municipalities to see what they did. And as you can see, it was a split about 50-50 on sharing versus no sharing. Each PUD that had sharing had their own variations on what the minimum construction amounts were and the eligibility terms. PUDs without sharing saw no real issues by not providing this program. We didn't hear any, you know, that there were any pushback from customers. And there were two cases that legal issues caused them to remove the program. And as he was speaking with utilities, there's one on the sharing side that is in the process of bringing a presentation to their board to eliminate it at this time. And legal issues can stem from a variety of sources, including the way sharing is calculated, who is eligible, timing of land sales, and length of customer eligibility. So I hope I didn't go through that too fast, but basically you can see here that staff has recommended that construction cost sharing be eliminated for the findings that you can see here. At this time, we're not asking for a motion. We wanted to present this to you so you guys can kind of absorb it and think about it and make a decision. And if you did end up approving the elimination, this would not eliminate sharing on the existing customer. So anyone who had signed an agreement and paid for construction, we would honor those agreements for the next 7 years as they kind of fall off the map there.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I could see that being a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But even that, even still administering the program for the next 7 years, but not having any new customers, it would still reduce our time quite a bit and I think add a lot of efficiency to our department. So with that, if you have any questions, feel free to ask. And if you could provide staff direction on what direction you would like to do, what you would like to do with this program, we could bring you a resolution as soon as the next commissioner meeting.
I think we probably need a little customer feedback on this one, so people.
Yeah, that's my feedback as well. Is that let's, you know, open this up for a couple of weeks anyway for customers to provide any feedback they want or have.
Yeah, that makes sense to us as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good presentation, Colin.
Yeah, that was. Very understandable. Okay, our next item is public comment on draft strategic plan. John?
Yeah, Colin, can you?
Yes.
There you go. All
right. Sorry.
No, that's fine. So, commissioners, in your board packets, staff compiled a 46-page document that memorialized all the verbal and written comments that we received from the work session on July 25th. And we went through each one of the comments and noted suggested edits, and then our recommendations we added to the copy of the strategic plan that is in your board packet, and those changes are highlighted in yellow. We are asking for your approval on the strategic plan today so that we can move forward in our budgeting process and begin developing strategic projects and capital work associated with our strategic plan. Also, to note, the meeting to discuss our strategic plan with the county commissioners is scheduled for September 12th. After that meeting, you all might want to add an addendum to our existing strategic plan if something substantial comes from that joint meeting with the county. So between now and then, any additional public comments that come in between when the board packet went out last week and September 12th, we can provide the commissioners with suggested edits for possible inclusion in the addendum. So with that in mind, we are asking for your support in a motion and vote to approve the strategic plan as provided in your board packet so that we can proceed forward with our budgeting and strategic projects process.
Yeah, Sean, I think that sounds reasonable. And without going through every one of the edits again, but and I note that you did get comments from Ken Hayes and a long list, and I thought that some of those were very good word changes that maybe we can pick up next time, or there are comments that really might better go into the addendum we're talking about, because that addendum could, you know, is obviously could include things of a broader nature, a longer range nature, and stuff like that. And I think, you know, dialogue with the commissioners and tribes and other folks like EDC and so forth is good. Now, we I don't know that we want to say September 12th is sort of the deadline for creating an addendum, but we could, because there's other groups, like I'm going to meet with my tribes you know, kind of, you know, get their vision of things too. So. So that's my only comment at this point.
I can't tell if you were speaking, Will, but you were muted.
Yeah, I'm muted. I'm sorry. There is some urgency in getting this done so we can move forward in planning our future projects and so on. Is that not true, John?
No, that is true. That's why I'm asking for your approval on the plan that was provided in your packet, which includes the edits from the July 25th work session. So what I was saying basically is that any edits or suggestions that come in between when your board packet went out last week and September 12th, staff could review those, provide them to the commissioners for possible inclusion into any addendum. I think what Jim is asking is that we don't set a hard stop on September 12th for the addendum.
Right.
So at some point, you do need to bring this to some kind of conclusion. I read through Ken Hayes' comments, which were very lengthy. I'm sure he spent a lot of time on that, but I think it was kind of a group effort. So anyway, it's worth reading. Okay, so do you have a motion to go ahead and approve this?
Move that we accept the strategic plan.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the 2023 strategic plan as revised. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. Okay, and then we move on to our BPA post-2028 contract discussion from commissioners and staff.
Well, this is Rick. I've been trying to work my way through Bonneville's paper. And on page 49, I came across something I thought that was interesting. I guess historically, in previous rate cases, the PF rate has been dampened or reduced by assuming what the secondary revenues will be in the future.
Yeah.
And that's a guess. You know, no one knows what type of water year, no one knows what type of loads, and so it's just a shot in the dark. But the implication is that we have a moving target on the PF rate. And on page 49, Bonneville is suggesting a fix for that, which would basically, they named it the after-the-fact secondary revenue crediting framework. The bottom line is that, and I'm thinking of the PF rate, and this may be simple, simplistic way and not accurate, but let's just call the PF rate Tier 1. And what they're suggesting that we do is take all the secondary and put it into Tier 2. And what that would do is stabilize the PF rate so that when people go into rate discussions, they have at least a firm number for the PF rate, understanding that Tier 2 would have some uncertainty, and you would be adding secondary sales to that. Personally, I think it makes sense, but I'm open to hearing what others might think of the idea.
Hey, Rick, this is John. We looked at that as well, and to be honest with you, it's not entirely clear, because I believe the secondary sales currently under their current contract are built into the Tier 1 PF rate. And the way I interpret that, and it's not clear, that they would take secondary sales outside of the Tier 1 rate and then consider it a credit post-rate case where there's some type of refund, perhaps even a dividend, that preference customers would receive. So it's not entirely clear, but I don't think they're going to use that in any way to subsidize Tier 1. At least they don't do that in the current contract. So we probably need to ask some questions within WAPAG or within the groups that we participate to get a better handle on that to see what BPA is actually proposing.
Yeah, they talked about this dividend at the Public Power Council. There was a lot of questions, not that I was there, but I do have a representative there, that a lot of questions on what's the basis for that, just like you're asking, John. So we need more clarification.
Well, historically, if it was similar to the RDC, they would true it up at the end of the year, and then you would get a monthly credit for the next year.
That makes sense.
That's how they do the revenue distribution clause now. It's a monthly bill credit over their fiscal year. So that would be my guess is how they would make it work.
That's probably true, but I think we need that definition.
Yeah.
But it would be retroactive it would be after the fact as opposed to a guess. Now, one thing it would do is it would place, I guess, the risk and uncertainty on individual utilities in budgeting to make a guess of what that would be, because it could widely vary based on water year.
Yeah, because the PF rate's going to be higher.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, given that Tier 2 is from market and market prices are skyrocketing, this may be favorable, but anyway, we need more information on it.
Well, and on that subject, something else has come up in I guess some discussions between entities and BPA. When they first started talking about the BP24 rate case, they were saying it was looking like a high $30 per megawatt hour for Tier 2. In subsequent discussions, it appears that has changed radically, and it will be close to the mid-C forward market, which is looking like between $60 and $70 per megawatt hour. That's almost double what tier cost was in the current rate case. Now, when they made their change from critical water to the P10 30 year, it did lower our Tier 2 outlook to a little over one average megawatt from something close to four. But for that one average megawatt for BP24, we will be paying somewhere between $60 and $70 per megawatt hour as things now stand based on the latest rate case discussions. Now, back in February, staff gave a presentation pointing out the elevated market power cost. At that, we were thinking something along the lines of up to $55 a megawatt hour. But the main thing to think about now, needless to say what it comes out to, the landscape has radically changed. When you're talking $60 to $70 a megawatt hour, you look at things like SMR nuclear, regional wind and solar are actually very likely to be more competitive than BPA Tier 2. So for utilities that are low following that have an option to serve above contract high watermark load, then it's going to be a strong incentive to go out and either try to get BPA to augment or find sources yourself to serve above contract high watermark load. And things like even the Energy Northwest Columbia generation upgrade, the economics totally changed on that, because before we were looking at $39. And now we're looking at something between $60 and $70 a megawatt hour. So I'm thinking as we go into BP28, this is going to be a major incentive to develop power sources, non-carbon, that's going to promote that. And we're going to have to be thinking about that going into the next contract. Because nobody's going to want to pay $60 to $70 a megawatt hour for BPA Tier 2 when you can get those options on your own.
John, when I was reading through the contract or the paper that Bonneville released on the contract, it made me wonder if part of the incentive from Bonneville was exactly what you're saying, that rather than having Bonneville be the party that goes out and develops new resources, that Bonneville is providing at least a partial incentive for utilities to go out and do it themselves.
I'm not aware of internal BPA discussions, but there are a lot of interests that are served for the Tier 2 rate not being so low,
because if the Tier 2 rate remained low, and let's say that Bonneville subsidized it with excess hydro, then it puts a clamp on development of new resources. So I think there's some discussions internally at BPA, perhaps even considering the interest of NRU, TEA, generators, those trying to get marketing for solar and nuclear. It worked against them with a low Tier 2 rate, and now it doesn't work against them. It works in their favor.
Yeah, that, from the accounts I heard, Harrison kind of got beat up at PPC about the EPU, the extended power upgrade at Columbia, although that's going to be Tier 1. But also the discussion of new resources developed either by Bonneville or incentivizing elsewhere. Now, if you look at the grant model for their SMR, they're going to build that thing and sign power sale contracts. So that's going to push a lot of people their way if that happens. So.
No, absolutely. And when you talk about Columbia upgrade, what it does is it displaces what would have otherwise be Tier 2 and makes it Tier 1 for the amount of the upgrade.
Yeah.
So you're looking at the differential between Tier 1 and Tier 2.
But I think this is the reason Bonneville changed their position. You know, Energy Northwest requested $31 million to continue engineering and licensing studies on the upgrade. And they said no and didn't include it in their budget. And then they turned around and did approve it. So you've got to use leverage.
One other issue, WAPAG has been pushing utilities to come up with defining system size. I brought this up at the last meeting and didn't really get any response back. And I'm wondering, does our PUD have a position on system size for the new contract? Well, and I'll speak up. I do not think Bonneville does a great job in procuring resources. And I will use Tenasca as an example. Therefore, I would argue or propose that the system size should be the firm capability of the hydro system and under critical water, not average, not P10 or maybe P10, but certainly not average, which would put, from my perspective, Bonneville potentially in the market 50% of the time to supplement or augment the system.
Yeah, well, and based on my read of the white paper, I think it's either going to be critical or something like P1030. I don't think Bonneville is going to move off of either one of those options, one or the other.
I think you're right, John.
Always enjoy Bonneville's choice of language, like the they always inform Energy Northwest of their budget approval, and it breeds non-disapproval.
now there is a couple things that BPA is already wavering on with respect to the concept paper. They're again talking about differentiating carbon in Tier 1 and Tier 2 supply, and they're also seem to be more inclined than what they said in the position paper was, which was all the utilities are on their own, but now they're definitely thinking about committing to a Tier 1 finished product that is carbon-free. So just because it's in the concept paper doesn't mean that that's a marker. I think they're wavering on a lot of those issues. And it does appear that it's more likely the interconnect analysis requirement is going to be elevated from 200 kilowatt to 1 megawatt.
So, commissioners, to go back real quick to Rick's request, are you okay if we communicate to Ryan that we prefer either critical water or P10?
I am.
I guess I'd rather hear some more dialogue from WAPAG.
No, I think the position that Rick just supported is, you know, that would give us some thin end of the wedge with WAPAG as to what our preference is. So,
well, from the staff standpoint, as long as the contract high water marks are reset for the new contract, I'm not sure it's going to have a big negative impact. If we were stuck with the contract high water marks of the current contract, it would work to our disadvantage. But since it appears they're going to reset those with a new contract, it basically looks like it's going to cover predominantly growth, and each utility will probably start off with either a similar deficit or excess, probably deficit.
As you said before, though, the position paper doesn't necessarily indicate what we're going to see in the contract, so we still have to keep trying to influence that process.
Especially since some parties, especially it seems Clark, is really on board with Bonneville going out and acquiring new resources, or at least that's what I heard at the WAPAG meeting one before last.
Yeah, just along those lines, there's two, there's room for two SMRs on site one, which is the nuclear, the dead nuke next to CGS. And we keep, Energy Northwest keeps suggesting to Bonneville that it would be a perfect place to build a new resource by Bonneville, but they haven't bidden on that yet. Anything else on that?
Not for me.
Okay, moving on to, and I see we got a hand up, but let's wait. We're going to get to public comments here in a minute.
This is a public comment that, Will, it's hard to hear you, and I'm afraid it's not going to get on the recording good enough for us to listen to at a later time also.
Okay, well.
That's all. That's all it was.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's much better. Thank you.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay, correspondence communication. Sean, do we have any?
Yeah, I got a couple things today. This is a repeat earlier, but the county commissioners have requested to attend one of our meetings on September 12th. So my plan was to put that as the first business item. They want to talk about our strategic plan. I think more importantly, they want to talk about the Carlsberg water rights expansion efforts. Commissioner Ozias in his email to me indicated that he will be asking Steve Gray and Carol Creasy to attend from the Public Works Department. And so I've asked Tom Martin to also be available for that meeting as well. Just want to make sure that September 12th works for all of you, that you will be available for our regular meeting.
So they're coming to our meeting?
Correct.
Okay. I think I'm available, but who knows?
Works for my schedule.
Okay. And if you're not, let me know by the end of this week, please.
Okay, good.
Okay, so the second one is also an invitation. The city of Sequim extended an invitation to all three of you for a meet and greet. They would also like to do September 12th, but it's from 5 to 6 p.m. at the city of Sequim chambers. The purpose that they relayed to me was for a meet and greet and brief discussion. And as you might recall, Deputy Mayor Brandon Janicey sent an email with a few questions regarding the BPA contract. So I'm assuming that that might be a topic that they have some questions on during the joint meeting. So again, just trying to check your availability, see if you'd be available for a joint meeting at their place of business on September 12th from 5 to 6 p.m.
Do we have an agenda or topics? Now, we're assuming what they want to talk about, but are they telling us what they would like to discuss?
I've asked them to provide me with an agenda, and I haven't received it yet. Will, I'm just trying to make sure that date works, and then I'll have them give me an agenda.
Okay.
Sean, was that the same date as the previous meeting you talked about?
It is. It's also September 12th, but from 5 to 6 p.m.
So this is not virtual. This is in person.
They are requesting an in-person meeting at their city council chambers.
Well, that's kind of problematic because we're still meeting virtually. Kind of defeats that if we meet with them in person.
I can ask them if they have a virtual option, if that would be the preference.
Okay.
Okay. I'll reach out and ask. And again, just let me know if that date doesn't work for you.
It works.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on, I forwarded all of you the communication from Robert Knapp with the Jamestown Tribe. They didn't have specific comments to our 2023 strategic plan. Instead, they have asked for a continued dialogue with the PUD and the tribe. And specifically, they requested PUD commissioners to engage with tribal leadership. So my thought was I could work with Mr. Knapp on coordinating a joint session later this fall. And earlier today, I sent you an email with three potential dates. So if you guys would review that and just let me know if any of those dates do not work for you so that I can coordinate with Jamestown on a joint meeting with them. And again, I would set this up for one of the dates that I gave you are for our regular meeting times.
Is Ron Allen still chairman there or not? Do we know?
I believe that he is.
Hmm. Interesting.
Those days work for me, Sean.
Okay.
So what was that date for Jamestown?
In the email I sent three potential dates. It was October 10th or 24th or November 14th.
And they pick, right?
They would pick, yeah.
Okay.
I think I'm open on all those.
Okay. All right. So, Broadband Summit, the North Olympic Development Council, in conjunction with the Colin Broadband team, which we are a member, is hosting a Broadband Summit on September 1st from 10 to 4 p.m. It's going to be held at Seven Cedars Hotel and Casino, and the summit is specifically geared toward broadband project developers and local ISPs. So the PUD is a co-sponsor of the event, and if any of you are interested in attending, please let me know by the end of this week, and I will forward you an email with how you can register, or I can have T register for you if it's something that you're interested in. It's going to be a pretty small group. With I can't remember everybody who's coming, but everybody who's on the Colin Broadband team is invited, as well as the local ISPs. So I'm guessing it would be maybe 20 to 25 individuals. So,
hey Sean, this is John. It's looking like it may be as many as 40 or 50.
Okay.
Mason is coming. I think a speaker from the broadband office, and maybe someone on grants. The big unknown is how many of the ISPs will be showing up, but it will be, of course, the county and ODC, us, and Jefferson PUD.
So on the staff side, we already participate in the NODC and the broadband task force, or whatever they're calling it. Those staff members would be going, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So if any of you are interested in attending, just let me know by the end of this week, and I'll get you the information to register. Okay, so the next thing here, Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, the director of the Northwest Lab has arranged a roundtable on community collaborations for climate and energy resilience in rural areas, consisting of U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm, Congressman Derek Kilmer, State Representative Steve Theringer, PNL Tribal Chairman, the NODC and our PUD. The roundtable is scheduled for this Wednesday at PNL, and John and I got invites to attend for our PUD. And the dialogue is going to focus on the energy needs of the North Olympic Peninsula, which includes Collin and Jefferson counties, including challenges and opportunities associated with integration of emerging carbon-free technologies and system infrastructure upgrades. Secretary Granholm will share remarks on the department's vision for supporting rural energy transitions and the importance of community partnerships. So that's going to happen this Wednesday, and I'll be able to report on that at the next board meeting, how that goes.
Great.
Hey, Sean. And,
yeah.
That kind of dialogue is an example of what I'm talking about getting regional or countywide input that could help shape the strategic addendum we're talking about.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I'm looking forward to it, and it's pretty impressive that the U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Granholm is going to be present. So I know P&L is pretty excited about her coming to town.
When is that, Wednesday?
Yeah, it's on Wednesday. And then finally, the last topic, which is everybody's favorite, COVID. The county dashboard continues to show declining numbers. It looks like last week on Monday it was 562, and this week, today, it's at 509. We do plan to be at the fair next week interacting with our customers, and I checked on this. We have not had any at-work transmission the last 2 months. All the employee cases that have come through have been community transmission. If commissioners are okay opening the lobby, we would not open the public meeting spaces to the public, and we would continue to hold all of our board meetings virtually. So basically, are you comfortable opening the lobbies, or would you still like to hold off until the case rates decline even further?
I'm okay with opening the lobby.
You may have mentioned this, but what's the case rate right now?
It was 562 last Monday, and today it was 509. They're only updating it weekly now instead of every day. It's been declining the last several weeks. But our original threshold that we set was the 200 per 100,000. And so we're about 2.5 times that number right now. Mm-hmm. The concern is that like I brought up last meeting, we're going to be interacting with our customers at the fair, and to not have our lobby open, and just concerned about the message that continues to send.
Sounds like Sean's looking for some direction here, so Jim's in favor. What do you think, Rick?
I'm uncertain.
There's no certainty with COVID. You just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the silver lining for me is that we haven't had any at-work transmission for at least the last 8 weeks. All the employees that have contracted COVID at this point have gotten it outside of the work. So that's good news and positive for me. If we do start to have at-work transmission, I would be happy to close it down again and make sure that our employees are safe, and that, I mean, we are an essential service provider in the county, so I take that seriously, but I also want to make sure that we serve our customers to the best of our ability, too.
Do any of these employees have the so-called long COVID or kind of persistent?
You know, not to my knowledge, Bill, that doesn't mean that we don't have any, but the cases that I've been made aware of, most people have been communicating recently that it's a bad cold and that they're getting over it within 7 to 10 days.
Okay.
Sean, I'll add the mortality rate and hospitalization rate is very, very far away from what it was a year or two ago, by decimal point, meaning the hospital, they're not seeing a whole lot of admissions, and the mortality is a very small fraction of what it was last year and the year before.
Well, on Sean's recommendation, I'm okay with it.
Okay, well, let's try it and see what happens, but we need to continue to monitor the case. Number
okay.
cases and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I'll work with customer service to come up with a firm date for reopening. We can't just flip a switch and do it, but I'll make sure to work with Nicole, and we'll get communications out when that will happen. And like I said, we'll continue to monitor. If we have any at-work transmission, we'll take the necessary steps to close again.
Okay, thank you, Sean.
And that is all of it I had today, Will.
Okay, good. All right, Commissioner reports. Jim, you want to lead it off?
Yeah, I guess I attended the Northwest Power Conservation Council, the Resource Adequacy Advisory Committee last week or whatever it was. And they went over some of the things that they were trying to improve on the Genesis model, particularly around hydro operations in terms of constraints and priorities for hydro plants, sources of operating constraints, simulated operations and so forth, and also market availability and price. So they're, what they're doing is they basically are taking a lot of the comments that they heard during the, the past, well, almost year when they were getting ready for the power plan and are trying to incorporate that, you know, and updating the Genesis model before they begin an actual resource adequacy assessment. I also attended the Economic Development Council had a board meeting. We had presentations on state folks giving, you know, what are the criteria or the, I guess, the what is the minimum wage, the survival wage, the subsistence wage, and so forth, that, and what it should be for this county. And it was pretty interesting that the way the government kind of does it is it's almost like a subsistence salary is what they call, you know, living wage. And what that means is you basically got enough money to pay your rent, pay your electricity, and feed yourself. But if you have anything come up, like a car repair or something, you're sunk. And so what the county, the EDC folks, of course, working with the state are, so what is a more reasonable number, a living wage or something like that? And the numbers they're coming up with are like $60,000 something a year, which are a lot higher than the medium wage here in Clallam County, especially when you look at non-government employees, you know, the businesses. And so I think it's just another example of why it behooves us to be very cautious about our rates and maybe, you know, the fact that, okay, so we have a theoretically a cheap electricity rate, but if you're 100% electrical and you're barely making a living, then, you know, small increases can make a big difference. And, you know, whether you, you know, keep your house at 65 or 61 degrees in the winter and stuff like that. The other thing I did, I also went to the WAPAG meeting. We kind of covered some of that discussion in the previous ones, but I also got an invite to listen in on a presentation by a group down in Eugene, Oregon last week, and it was an in-person meeting with a community group, and it was also on Zoom. And it was a freebie, just one of those things I thought I'd just listen to on Saturday. And it had the participants were Shannon Wheeler from the Nez Perce Tribe, Nancy Hirsch from the Northwest Energy Coalition, and Todd Truve, who is the lead attorney with the plaintiffs with Earth Justice on this federal case, and also Kurt Miller. And, you know, while the Todd Truve and Nancy said some things that I thought, well, that's really not all that accurate. It's a bit of a hyperbole and so forth. I was really disappointed in what Kurt Miller came out with. He was giving one after another really, really misleading statements. And the way the thing was formatted, basically everybody talked, and there wasn't much time for counter arguments between the group because they wanted to have some public questions, but that there was only time for two. I tried to put a question in, but they, point out something to Kurt, but it wasn't read. But it was really disappointing, you know, to hear some of the outlandish things and claims he's making. And this whole thing was about the Lower Snake Dams. And so, you know, it was really disturbing. And it bothers me that we're paying money to an organization like this, and they're just spewing out really ridiculous, irrational stuff. And I'm not suggesting at this point anything. I'm just saying, you know, I'm registering a sort of an observation and I guess a complaint that I'm not at all happy with what Kurt has said and the inability to correct him in these situations. I mean, he basically pumped his stuff out and several hundred people believed him because he was on that panel. That's all.
Okay, Rick, do you have anything to report?
I was at the WAPAG meeting. There they talked about the BP24 workshop, talked about Tier 2 rates and how in the last contract they were lower than Tier 1. Talked about a potential carbon adder and that the market has almost doubled since the previous meeting that they had had. Talked about the Western Resource Adequacy Program, and then they talked about demand rates, which I thought was all a very interesting and productive meeting. That's all I've got.
Okay, thank you, Rick. Well, I attended a board of directors meeting at Energy Northwest, as well as a joint meeting with the executive board at Energy Northwest. During the board of directors meeting, there was a presentation by our consultant we use for compensation. And it was pretty interesting in that he talked about inflation, salary trends, and so on. Things like, what they do is they go out and gauge industry, and they're specific to the utility industry. And a lot of respondents to that survey said that they were revising their compensation to do something about inflation, but they're not quite matching, they're well below the inflation rates that we see now. Some of the interesting points was that there's a lot of mobility in employees because of the job situation, and two-fifths of employees said that they would leave their current job just for as little as a 5% increase or less. Everybody's having trouble attracting and retaining talent, the skill pools that they need. And this is especially true of digital skills professionals and hourly employees. The two-thirds of the respondents have increased their recruitment efforts. 66% have increased their recruitment efforts. And they're looking at pay, health benefits, and job security, which are the key factors to attract and retain employees. So no surprise there. Then moving on to, and I'm sorry, I've got to refresh myself here a bit. The board of directors also had a had presentations from the chief nuclear officer. We did, the CGS did have some downtime due to not only economic dispatch, but also some equipment problems. Then we got into the energy services and development, and quite a bit to talk about there. I won't go into all of it, but Nine Canyon and Packwood and all of those Energy Northwest wind farm and dam resources are doing well. The let me get down to this. The Horn Rapids Battery Energy Storage System. That's where we have an 8-megawatt solar farm with a 1-megawatt battery. That battery has experienced some problems, so they actually had to bring in technicians from China to work on it. Anyway, it's back up with the exception of the HVAC units keeping the battery cool, or two of the four are waiting replacements, and so that's reducing the amount of the functionality of the battery. Move on to, I won't go into demand side management. Let's talk about electrification of transportation. This is the EVITA, which is the Electrical Vehicle Infrastructure for Transportation Allowance. The biggest news there to me, or to us, I guess, was that we applied for grants to put in charging stations on the 101 loop through mainly Clallam County. And that's administered by the state, and they did not approve that, although they did encourage us to reapply. They implied that this would be next up in the queue to be financed. So they will reapply next year. And that's about a $3.4 million project. And the other solar system, the 150-megawatt Ruby Flats, that's ongoing permitting and meeting. In March of this year, they'll have a permitting meeting. They will start construction in January of 23 and energize in 2023. That's going to be a major solar project. Then moving on to Grant PUD's new nuclear program, they're going to, this month, they're going to decide which technology to use. They've been, they've signed memos of understanding with both X-Energy and NuScale. They're going to decide which way to go. Seem to be leaning towards X-Energy, but that's not a given.
Hey, Will, did Grant decide where they're going to site it?
No, that's one of the problems. You know, initially they were going to site it on Site 1 next to Columbia Generating Station. But they decided for the high-value asset like that, they wanted it in their county. They think it's going to produce some jobs and some economic impact. So they've come up with three proposed locations in Grant County. And the Department of Energy of the NRC has looked at those. They've rejected one because it's next to an airport. And when they grounded all those, what were they called, the Boeing planes that were grounded, they had just hundreds of those planes fly in there and parked. And so that kind of killed that location. But they do have two other alternate sites, which will have to be approved by, you know, they have to be licensed for nuclear activity. And so NRC has final word on that. Other new nuclear opportunities. Energy Northwest has signed a memo of understanding with Curio. This is the company that's developing the technology to recycle spent fuel. And part of that understanding would be that Energy Northwest would look at, consider, almost have committed to load, be the first reactor to load that recycled fuel. The they also we're talking with Westinghouse for their micro reactors, and that's ongoing and probably will happen here shortly. Then we moved on to the executive board meeting. We approved a addendums or revisions to the budget. Of course, with everything today, with they talked about it, about supply chain issues, trying to get ready for the next refueling outage. One of the points was that they tried to buy 2x4s, which I don't ask me why 2x4s are needed for refueling a reactor, but in any case, they were asking $500 per board. And I told them I had one in my garage, I'd give them for $400, but anyway. let's see, that's probably about enough, but anyway, we've got a meeting, a workshop coming up here later this month at Port Ludlow, where we're going to talk about a strategic plan, talk about I'm going to reassign committee members and chairman and so on. But that'll be an interesting meeting because we're looking at new opportunities and somewhat outside of nuclear. There's plenty of opportunities in nuclear, but we're looking for other opportunities for Energy Northwest as a joint operating agency, you know, with 28 member PUDs. So we'll see how that goes. That's probably enough. Any questions? Anything on that? Okay, staff reports. We've got a briefing on Climate Commitment Act by Tyler.
Hi, I'm Tyler King. I'm going to be reporting on the Climate Commitment Act. Next slide, please. The Climate Commitment Act is an county-wide cap and invest program. California is the only state with this type of program in place currently. This was passed in 2021, and it will begin in 2023, administered by the Department of Ecology. Rules are still being finalized. Expect the final rules to come October this year. Next slide, please. The program includes in-state generation and imported electricity. The entity with the obligation for complying with the program for the electricity sector is called the First Jurisdictional Deliverer, which I will be referring to as FJD. BPA power is considered imported electricity. The program covers imported electricity if cumulative annual total is greater than 25,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent. The CCA gives BPA the option to decide to participate in Washington's program as the FJD.
Hey, Tyler?
Yes, Rick.
I believe that the majority of Bonneville's generation is in the state of Washington. So why is all of the Bonneville power, do you have any idea why all the Bonneville power is considered imported?
Yes, I asked this question also. It's called a statutory construct. Anytime, if BPA were to sell in Washington state power outside the state, they would be subjected to the Climate Commitment Act rules. And I guess there are some very complicated rules that would hinder exports to California, Idaho, Oregon. So that's the reasoning behind the need to make them an exported power.
Be more defined by where the generation is rather than just making an administrative call on it to me.
And they were in legislation, they figured that Bonneville is a federal entity, and to give it just one state for generation, it and with all the generating resources Bonneville cumulatively has, they felt that it should be imported power wherever it goes.
Thank you.
Tyler, what does CO2 equivalent, what's the equivalent? Does that include methane or what?
I actually don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. That's just the terminology that they use.
Well, yes, it does include methane, and typically what they do is they average carbon, CO2, methane over 100 years, or now 30 years, because methane is such a fast degrading gas that its major impact is in the first 10 years. But anyway, the COTE just indicates that any carbon compound like methane would be included in COTE. And Tyler, the question I have, the cumulative annual total. So if that's so like all of BPA's power added up, if it's greater than 25,000 metric tons, then this applies to them, right?
Yes. If they decide to participate in Washington's program, then we will fall under BPA.
So,
okay, next slide.
So that's Bonneville's decision to do that?
Yes.
Well, hey, Tyler, this is John. Is it not also our decision?
We can decide to be the FJD also. But if Bonneville decides they want to, they actually sort of supersede us.
Okay, so but right now we do not know if Bonneville will be the first jurisdiction or not, and for the first year they will not be. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
So is this an either or? If Bonneville opts not to do this, then it falls on us to do it or other utilities?
I'll get to that.
Okay. Sorry. Go
ahead. Thanks, Will. So all utilities are eligible for no cost free allowances for their cost burden under the program. These are calculated consistent with a forecast of emissions as long as they are in compliance with CETA. The Department of Ecology will be looking at a Clean Edge implementation plan and reviewing them for how many of these no-cost free allowances we'll receive. Method and quantity of allocations are to be determined. Customer must register with the Department of Ecology to receive allowances. Allowances can be transferred to or auctioned or even banked. Next slide. If BPA does not elect to be the FJD, as John stated, BPA will not be the FJD for 2023, but we'll consider 2024 after Washington finalizes the program rules in October. They decided in 2023, it's just too late to wrap up into the rate case, and they just don't know the costs yet. BPA will not be responsible for compliance if they are not the FJD, but they will have an administrative workload regardless. They will have to do greenhouse gas calculations and other reporting measures. BPA costs will be zero. And $1.5 million for BPA customers over the threshold. There is about six or seven BPA customers that will be required to purchase allowances. And according to the cost calculation, the assumption is $32 per allowance. That's based on 2025 California cap and trade rules. There's increased risk to secondary revenues based on transactional friction and future EIN loss benefits. Next slide.
Wait, the transactional friction, I'm assuming you mean the cost for the CO2E?
Yes, and there's also going to be some complicated rules that will follow. And I think they are not quite completed yet, but they're worried that that there is going to be more complexity in the trades. I'm not familiar with the technicalities on it.
So who's writing the rules? Department of Commerce or?
Department of Ecology.
Oh, Ecology. Hmm.
Next slide, please. All BPA customers will indirectly be covered under the program if BPA does become the FJD. So every BPA customer, no matter how large or small, will be covered under the program. Annual costs will be estimated to be $2.4 million total. And that includes $550,000 attributed to the smaller customers that would otherwise not be brought under the program if BPA did not become the FJD. BPA believes there will be reduced risk to secondary revenues. Larger customers could avoid triggers with the threshold for non-federal purchases if not combined with federal purchases. So federal purchases go in one bucket and non-federal go in another. Next slide. Transactional friction. If value of BPA energy, or basically the value of BPA energy is expected to increase under this program because they have carbon-free energy up to about 5 to 10%. If BPA is not the FGD, the price BPA receives is expected to be lower due to unique FGD cost exposure rules for power used to serve Washington loads. For the EIN, BPA must be the FGD in California cap and trade program to receive EIN dispatch orders for California loads. The same rules may apply for Washington loads. We really don't know yet, but we're suspecting that Washington is modeling the cap and trade program after California. Next slide. Here's an analysis. 25,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent is equal to 7 average megawatts of unspecified market purchases or 142 average megawatts of BPA power purchased in an average water year. Currently, our latest calendar year retail or load was 79.235 average megawatts from BPA, calculated out as 18,503 megatons of CO2. So we do fall under the 25,000. So we do not, we're not required to participate in this program. In the event of poor water year, where BPA has greater than 8.2% unspecified market purchases, Crown PUD must comply with obligation under the CCA. Next slide, please. Okay, the goals of the Climate Commitment Act. The revenue estimates for Washington are nearly $1 billion per year for by the late 2020s. The total number of credits allowances would shrink each year, increasing the price of pollution. They plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 95% by 2050. Proceeds from the CCA allowance auctions must be invested in critical climate projects, addressing issues in environmental justice and inequality, or inequity, sorry. Also requiring 35% of funds be invested in projects for overburdened communities, and a minimum of 10% go to projects with private support. So next, we need to register with the Department of Ecology. The second thing we need to do is send the Department of Ecology a board-approved forecast of greenhouse gas emissions and total load for the calendar year 2023. And we will receive free allowances. Any questions?
Tyler, I was struck by the $1 billion per year by the late 2020s for Washington consumers. I don't know the population or the number of households, but that seems to be a significant amount of money that rates are going to be going up to accommodate.
Well, yes, that's correct. Oregon has voted their cap and trade legislation down twice. And the reason behind it is they were afraid that the economy would be crippled.
Yeah, that's my concern as well. John, I'm wondering if you have a back-of-the-envelope guesstimate of what that would do to ratepayers?
I think it's about $125 a person in the state, Rick.
Yeah, but usually, every person in a household doesn't, have their individual So it's, you know, for a family of four, we're talking close to $500 in.
John, I think you're muted.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The average would be probably somewhere between $250 and $300 per household. But at the same time, you got to remember we're subject to CETA, and this kind of overlays CETA, and is somewhat redundant to CETA obligations. We're supposed to remove carbon from the power supply, so it's going to be interesting how this works in conjunction with CETA and the mandatory carbon reductions in that legislation.
Boy, you know, when they passed the Energy Independence Act and then they started talking about other things, we were worried about pancaking. We got a tall stack here. So, anyway.
Well, and there's a lot of other unknowns. So right now we're assigned for unspecified purchases something equivalent to natural gas penalty. And that may change going forward. We may actually have a different distribution that would include renewables. So that may mitigate this somewhat, but right now we just don't know. We don't even know if BPA is going to be the first jurisdiction or we are. But for the near term, it should not have an impact over the next rate case, I guess, next couple of years for sure, unless we just have a terrible water year.
Yeah, so looking forward, we will be bringing a forecast to the board for approval before the end of the year.
A forecast on how you think it's going to affect rates? Is that what you mean?
Well, actually, more of a forecast on the load and the greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay.
And that
would like to hear the story about rates too at some point.
Oh yeah. Right now it doesn't seem to impact rates because we're not covered. We're not subject to the act yet. But if Bonneville does become the FJD, it's going to cost them money, $2.4 billion total estimated, and that is definitely going to have to come from rates.
I guess the question would be, or a question we need to think about, is do we want Bonneville to be the FJD? I'm assuming the answer is yes, but I think we would have to think about what the cost would be if Public Power were to do it on their own, and could they do it cheaper than Bonneville?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I know if BPA becomes the FJD, and I had a discussion this morning with a BPA representative on this, they believe that their secondary sales will be dramatically better if they are the FJD based on the Climate Commitment Act rules. And if their secondary sales are higher, previously we would get a credit based on forecasted secondary sales baked into the PF rate, but now we will likely get a credit at the end of the year based on secondary sales. So it might actually save the utility money.
Well, we don't have to get into it now, but I'd be interested to hear what the impact this will have on 2028 contracts if Bonneville makes a choice here.
Yes. All right. That concludes the presentation.
Okay. Tyler, thank you very much.
Yes, thank
interesting
you.
Stuff. Okay. T, do we have action items?
I have some action items, Will. The first one is to create an addendum to the strategic plan and bring it to the board within the next month. Second item is to set dates for joint meetings with the county, the City of Flint, and Jamestown Tribe, and communicate that to the commissioners. Third item is to advise on the lobby open date. And the fourth item, I wasn't sure if this was a real item or not, but it sounds like we need to bring a forecast before the board on greenhouse gas emissions and load before the end of the year. That's what I have.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, we're coming up to our next comments from the public. Please raise your hand or let T know if you have a comment.
I am not seeing any raised hands, Will.
Surprising. Okay, we do not have an executive session, so if there's no more business to come before the board, we will adjourn. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, commissioners. Have a good afternoon.